you so much, Ian, and actually, the privilege has been mine and not yours to co-teach that course. It has been fabulous fun. I'm going to share a prologue before I begin, which is a piece of what I had planned to present today and what I deleted. So you're not going to get the deleted first draft of this, but I had planned to focus on mental health because I don't have the kind of expertise that Wendy Mariner has or that Bishop Fisher has. So I had decided to go in my area of expertise, which would be mental health. I decided against doing that because when I realized I was going to be at the end, I decided instead to focus on practices of healing. So that's what I'm planning to do. But before I move to that, I want to make a connection that links with what both Bishop Fisher and Wendy Mariner did earlier. You remember Wendy Mariner began with the three words. I think the first one was vulnerability. Am I remembering that right?
Victim.
Sorry, Wendy, I didn't see you there.
Victim.
Victim,
Vessel, and Venus.
And as I started the preparation for the mental health work, I was aware that women are often either taken to be the most pitiful, vulnerable, mentally ill people on the face of the earth, or they are blamed for other people's lack of mental health. And I could develop that statistically, as Bishop Fisher did so brilliantly in the last hour. I'm not going to do that, but I'm going to name two examples that I think you'll catch fairly quickly. The first example is the kind of work that Sigmund Freud did at the turn of the 20th century, in which he was focused primarily on the mental illness of anxiety, which he found largely in his women patients. And he developed a whole theory of psychoanalysis and a whole theory of mental illness that was grounded in anxiety at its core and that saw that as primarily a women's mental illness, or more often than not, a women's mental illness. And he was the most influential figure in the mental health world and the psychotherapeutic world for over 100 years. He continues to have a huge influence. I'm not undermining the significance of his work. I'm simply pointing out that there was a gendered bias built into it that has not left. And the other piece I want to name is has to do with something that's much more recent, and that's the diagnosis of codependence. In the 70s and 80s and early 90s, there was a great blossoming of this disease of codependence that was found more among women than among men, and it was blamed for why the men in their lives were often alcoholic or had other kinds of problems. And so what you had was, actually, women were among the leaders of this movement. It was only in looking back on the movement, and I have, in this case, studied the literature pretty exhaustively, and it's as you go back through the psychological and sociological literature, you discover that women were often diagnosed as codependents, and codependence was a major factor in various kinds of dependent behavior, such as alcoholism, drug addiction, and so forth. And so what you had was a very subtle way of blaming women for many of the diseases of the society. Now you realize I'm exaggerating because it's not 100% this. But the reason I'm exaggerating is because sometimes that helps bring to visibility the kinds of gender factors that are not only involved in our legal systems and in our racial, ethnic diversity and the ways in which our social systems engage, but are also part of the way we do mental health in the US and in some other parts of the world. That's the prologue, and that's it. That's the part that's in the deletion file. And now I'm going to move to, do you want to sit down? Is there some seats? I'm going to do something of a different genre. from what we've done, which is genre storytelling. And I've titled this Faces of Women Facing Toward Healing. I invite you today to look into the faces of women to find passion for health and directions for the practice of healing. I'm not coming at this, I'll say this in a minute, but I'm not coming at this as an essentialist who thinks all women are alike and that women are this way and men are that way. None of that stuff. But I am coming at it with the assumption that if we really look deeply into women's lives, we often make important discoveries about healing and the practices that lend themselves to health. So I'm going to begin with two tiny vignettes, and then I'm going to tell you three other stories in a little bit more detail. The first two vignettes are BU related. Anna Howard Shaw did her first advanced degree at BU School of Theology. This is something we say ad nauseum here at BU School of Theology. But there are a couple of things that I've discovered in my study of Anna Howard Shaw that aren't as commonly spoken. And one of them is that she traveled by stagecoach from East Dennis, Massachusetts on the Cape to come to her classes here. So this was not an easy, frivolous thing for her to do. Another thing is that she started preaching when she was 16 years old because she was called to preach. There was no place for it. She just found places, and she did. But when she finished her degree here at the School of Theology and went back to serve churches on the Cape, she discovered that she wasn't quite fulfilling the vocation she thought she had been called to fulfill. Because she could minister to people's spiritual needs, but she couldn't minister to their physical needs. And she really felt that she was called to minister to whole people. And so she came back to BU again on a stagecoach and completed a medical degree some 11 years later. So here's a woman who traveled by stagecoach to do her degree and who had to have two advanced degrees in order to do what she thought God had called her to do. A couple other things. about Anna Howard Shaw. So when she finished all these degrees and was serving, she thought there was still something more that she was called to do. So she increasingly became involved in public service, particularly for her, the temperance movement and women's suffrage movement. She was the president of the National American Women's Suffrage Association from 1904 to 1915. Now, I'm going to say a little bit about that because her service in these was not flawless. It was not just focused on gender, but it was also, it was focused really on white women, and I'll come back to that later. But we see a similar trajectory in a contemporary, Gloria White Hammond, whom some of you know because she was awarded an honorary doctorate by Boston University just last May. And some of you know her personally because she's very active in Boston. But Gloria White Hammond is known as pastor, pediatrician, and world activist. So she has been reaching out to people of Darfur, Botswana, Cote d'Ivoire, and South Africa now for decades. And you see her, you'll know she's not many decades old. But beginning as a very young woman, she became quite an activist. So she co-pastors Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Boston while serving as a pediatrician in Boston's South End Community Health Center, while serving as the founding co-chair of the Massachusetts Coalition to Save Darfur, and chairing the quote unquote Million Voices for Darfur campaign. Now, she's also, just because she doesn't have enough to do, she's also the co-creator. Notice how often I use the term co-creator, co-founder, of the Red Tech Group that brings Christian and Jewish women together to study the Torah and the Bible. And she's also the co-founder of My Sister's Keeper, organized in 2002, working with women in the Sudan to find freedom and to build education and other services to sustain their lives. That just scratches the surface. Now, these are two faces of women. Faces that were facing toward healing. And that rumination makes me want to ponder a lot more faces of women. And so in the next part of what I'm going to share, I'm going to introduce three other women and tell a little bit about their stories. They come from different times and places. And then I'm going to look at the whole group of them and analyze what we might learn from them about practices of healing. And I'm going to shut up soon enough, I hope. I better take out my watch so I can make sure I do this, so that you can add to what I've said or subtract or multiply or divide. But I think I've only scratched the surface, so I'm hoping that you will enter into this also. So, narratives of women. The first one is Dorothy Ripley, who lived from 1879 to 1831. She was the daughter of a British Methodist local preacher. And in her late 20s, she had a dramatic religious experience. She went into her bedroom to worship God, and in her bedroom, this is what she recalls later, "The power of God struck me to the earth, where I lay as covered with God's glorious majesty, beholding as through his spirit the riches of his kingdom." Now that's a religious experience. The experience lasted several hours, and it was accompanied by a very strong sense of call. And she says about this call, "In this situation, the Lord commanded me to go 10,000 miles. Now, Ripley interpreted this vision and this calling as God's call to minister to Africa's children. She was white. Who were oppressed by American planters. So she saw herself as going to Africa to minister with the people of Africa because of the terrible oppression of slavery and what the American planters were doing. Now, she ended up doing something different, which you'll learn in a minute, but later on in her life, she thought about her calling and what she had done with her life, and she said these words, "Ah, the solitary path I took. Who but a God of everlasting strength could have brought me safe through?" Now, Ripley responded to her call not by going to Africa, but by coming to the United States and attacking those American planters head on. So her ministry in the United States was largely a minister with African Americans who were free, are enslaved, and a ministry of confrontation with white American planters and others, which you'll soon discover. She said to Thomas Jefferson, when she had an audience, she became fairly well known, so she had an audience with Thomas Jefferson. And she asked him how many slaves he owned, to which he replied, "Well, I used to own a whole lot more." And this is what she said. I told him that I was shocked to hear of the souls and bodies of men being exposed to sale like the brute creation. And she implored his pity and commiseration. So she was a woman of direct speech. According to her story, they parted in peace, but she didn't quit her work. She continued her mission for many years after that and talked with many planters and other slave owners, as well as talking eventually in Congress and in a lot of public gatherings. She became a well-known speaker on this circuit. Her ministry also expanded eventually to include prison reform and advocacy for Native Americans. It's interesting what you were saying earlier. Now, Dorothy Ripley's call was dramatic. Her story was a drama story. And it played a large role in her ability to follow this solitary path. Over decades of ministry, Ripley was frequently confronted with objections to her leadership, whether from slave owners or men who objected to women speaking and preaching, or women who objected to women speaking and preaching. Yet others urged her on, and she indeed did persist to the end of her life, and she died in this country, to which she had been called some 3 decades later. Now, another controversial figure of a very different kind, but I'm coming from the same part of the world, and at roughly the same time, was Mary Barrett Taft. Her life spanned 1772 to 1851. She also was a British Methodist, and she also felt a call by God to, in her case, to speak to and eventually to preach to others. She traveled for many years preaching and preaching in various venues and leading revival movements. She was a very popular revivalist, like someone else. I doubt if she had the fire that you had. She was a single woman initially, and later she married Zachariah Taft. And she continued her ministry because he was an ardent supporter of women preachers. And he actually was ostracized frequently himself because of his advocacy for women preachers and women leaders in this Methodist movement. But the two of them seem to have gotten along pretty famously. Obstacles were very common for Mary Taft, especially from professors of religion and ministers of the gospel. The term professors of religion doesn't have anything to do with BU professors or any other professors. It has to do with people who profess their faith. And many people who profess their faith thought that Mary Taft was very much out of line for professing her faith in the way that she did it. Yet she became quite popular, and she came to see that the objection of others was a natural part of following the call of God. If you're following the will of God, you have to expect that people are going to object, because God is going to lead you into unpopular places to do unpopular things, and so it's inevitable. She also came to appreciate the many friends who did support her, because they became a kind of anchor to keep her from giving up. And I'm quoting from her here. "I believe there never yet existed any singularly useful in the Church of God." I didn't read that too well, so you wouldn't know what it, let me start over, please. "I believe there never yet existed any person singularly useful in the Church of God who have not been oppressed by their fellow creatures in their benevolent career of doing good." Which makes you wonder, if you've never been critiqued, what have you not been doing? And she goes on to say, "In the midst of all, God had given me I'll use her language, his approving smile and a blessed consciousness. In addition to this, the Lord has graciously raised me up numerous friends." Now, that's true of a lot of these people. Dorothy Ripley talks about her solitary life, but for Mary Taft, Anna Howard Shaw, and Gloria White Hammond, friends are very present in this walk. In fact, one of Anna Howard Shaw's close friends was I had it here. I can't believe I've done it. I kind of blank out on Susan B. Anthony's name anyway, because I have such mixed feelings about her. Her leadership.
She was with her when she died. She was holding Susan B. Anthony's hand when she died.
I didn't know that. Did y'all hear what she just said?
Yeah.
She was, some say she was Susan B. Anthony's closest confidant for the longest period of time, but I didn't know that about her being with her in her head. So you see that for some of these women, friendship is really important. Mary Barrett Taft's ministry consisted of preaching, praying with others, holding public meetings, and correspondence. She valued the Methodist connection. So unlike Dorothy Ripley, who sort of created her own path, Mary Taft stayed close to the forms of the Methodist connection. So when she was asked to preach outside of her own circuit area, she said no almost every single time, because she felt like she was called to work within the structures, and this was a structure that she felt called to live within. But even with such loyalty to the connectional system, Mary Taft received persistent criticism from a few vocal clergy. Some of these eventually joined the ranks of her strongest supporters. So some of her biggest critics in the early years were some of her biggest supporters in the later years, which also is not too uncommon. But one of my favorite stories of Mary Taft reveals something about her compassion with her neighbors. When Mary Taft was walking down the street one day, she passed a house and she heard a baby cry. So she knocked on the door and asked the mother of the family, is there something wrong here? And is there anything I can do, because I hear your baby crying and I can tell your baby's really upset, and I'm guessing you probably are too. And the mother said, I'm at my wit's end. I can't. I don't have enough milk for this baby. The baby's not getting enough to eat. And she cries all the time. And I can't respond to the baby because I don't have what the baby needs. And Mary Taft said, well, would you mind if I just come in for a little while? I happen to have a child at home and I'm still nursing. And I would be very happy to nurse your baby. And so she did. And the baby went off to sleep. Before she left the house that day, she said to this woman, you know, I've been blessed with lots of milk, and I would love for you to come to my home every day, and I'll feed your baby. And she did. And then, being the evangelist that she was, she started ministering to other aspects of this woman's life, and the mother and the father became great followers of this tradition that Mary Taft represented. All began with hearing the baby's cry. In the face of controversy, Mary Taft paused from time to time to reassess her calling, and she realized that her calling might change over time, and she'd have to rethink it from time to time. And also, when she'd get really frustrated or really tired, she would have to stop and think. And what happened every time, and she reflects on this as she looks back on her life, is that in those moments she would reflect on, what is God calling me to do now? And she would move sometimes in the same direction, or sometimes in a slightly different direction. But she always found those times of pause to be times of strengthening. Even if it was strengthening to continue doing exactly what she had been doing already. But because she had this very active prayer life, she also loved to pray with others. And she would often offer to pray with others in the most unusual circumstances. She said about this herself, suffice it to say that the Almighty, in a most extraordinary manner, removed my scruples, answered my objections, and thrust me out into his vineyard. So it was a very active praying and then responding to what was stirring in her that would lead her to do bolder and bolder things as she walked through this life. Now the last portrait comes from the 20th century, and I suspect that this person is still living, but the story is told by Isabel Apollo Fiery in a book that is on healing in Africa. And it's an edited collection. It was written in honor of Mercy Amba Odioye, who many in Africa, many women especially, look to as their spiritual and social mother. And it's interesting that they chose to write a book, 2006, so this is a recent book, chose to write a book on healing in Africa. And one of the authors who's written in the book is Dr. Fieri, and she has done a lot of oral histories. And a lot of her oral histories are with women who are traditional healers. And so in this particular chapter, I'm going to share with you the story of the healer whose story she tells, and then let you kind of see into this healer who comes from a different culture from the others I've shared thus far. This is a woman healer among the KwaZulu-Natal people of Southern Africa. And this is a healer who experienced pretty severe violence in her lifetime, and you'll hear it as I share the story. This drew Fieri because Fieri recognized how many of the traditional African women leaders had experienced a lot of violence, and she realized how that had helped shape their religious leadership. The woman's name is Mpilo Munganda. And she shared her story with Dr. Fieri. That is not her real name. But she shared her story and said it was fine for Fieri to tell the story publicly. And so this is her story. Nampilo Mungando was in training to become a Sangoma, or a traditional healer in her culture, when she was 12 years old. Now, that particular training didn't last too long, but by the time she was 14, she was with a trainer, a Kwaza mother, who was her mentor in this training process, who helped her to grow as a healer. Now this is a very long process because it started at 12. Now she's 14, and before it's over, she's going to be much older than this. But she continued her training for some time. What I want you to know is that this was a time of political violence, huge political violence in the southern part of Africa. And one time when she lived with her Kwaza mother in this training process, along with a lot of other trainees. So one time she was there in the home with her Kwaza mother, and some of the quote unquote comrades came to the house and accused the Kwaza mother of harboring her brother, that is, the Kwaza mother's brother, who was accused of having done political acts that were inappropriate, according to the view of the comrades. They claimed that he was a security police informant. And then the Kwaza mother said, no, this is not the case. But they beat her, and they beat her badly with all of the trainees. Standing there. At that point, the Kwaza mother made herself disappear. And according to a footnote in this chapter, she could have made all of the trainees disappear as well, but she couldn't get to them to touch them. So the trainees were left there with these men. The men kidnapped all of the trainees, all women, young women, kidnapped them all, and threatened to kill them. In fact, by the time they actually took the women away, that the women knew that they were going to die. And so the comrades took them to another house, and while they were in this house, Nompilo escaped. Now, when she escaped, she changed her clothes because she was wearing the clothes of her trainee, which would label her immediately. She changed her clothes, but she was dodging bullets this whole time. And somehow her life was spared. She she went home, and she was with her birth mother, her family mother. And her family mother discovered that Nampilo, after she was healed from the brutal sexual abuse, oh, I'm sorry. I'm mixing up two parts of the story. I'm so sorry. She, backing up. So she's run away, she's gone back to her home. Her mother was taking care of her, and she realized that Nampilo was getting ill. And it didn't take her mother long to decide that she was ill because she was longing to be back in training. And to neglect this call was not good for her health. And so in order for her daughter to be restored to health, she had to send her daughter back into what could, again, be a dangerous situation. So her mother had to search, but she found the Thwaza mother. She sent Nampilo back to the Thwaza mother and as a trainer. And that the Thwaza mother had moved, and it was a safer situation. But one day, she went out on a walk to do an errand for her Thwaza mother. And while she was gone, she was picked up by two men, one black, one white. And they took her to a house where there were many corpses of young girls lying around. She knew this was the end. In that house, she was gang raped. She tried to escape. She was a virgin. So she was bleeding horribly, and she was in terrible pain, and she couldn't manage to escape their tight grip. At that moment, though, they decided not to kill her, and they took her to a bus stop and dumped her. A woman she didn't even know found her and took her home. Her mother tended her. She went to the hospital, and they tended her. They discovered that she was not pregnant, and she did not have HIV. A month later, she was supposed to go back. They discovered that she still didn't have HIV, but she was pregnant. Now, in their religious tradition, her mother was in the same tradition, to do anything about this child, to abort this child, was strictly prohibited. So she decided she would keep the child, this child of rape. She later looked back on this child as someone who helped her stay in touch with the violence that she experienced. Not in a reliving sort of way, but in a don't forget how bad life can be for folks sort of way. And so she completed her training, and she became a spiritual healer. Now, what was interesting about her life as a spiritual healer is that there were certain qualities that became really important. And one of those qualities was to tell her story to other people, especially other women who had been sexually abused, and to encourage them to tell their stories with one another and to her. So I'm going to read you a quote from her. Nampilo was willing to share her experience of rape with anyone who was willing to listen. She claimed to have come to terms with her experience and to have moved on with her life. The experience draws to Nampilo rape survivors who seek her out to share their stories. For those who are willing, she performs a healing ritual. The rituals are holistic. They reach into every aspect of the life of the person who has been violated and thus prepare the person for easy integration back into her community. Now, Nampilo had actually gone through two rituals after she was somewhat physically healed. One was a ritual of cleansing, which in her tradition restored her virginity, socially restored her virginity, which made her part of the community. The other ritual she went through was the ritual for her son to become a part of her father's family, to restore her son to community. So she became an ardent believer in the importance of ritual for restoration. But she didn't force it on people. So if someone didn't want to participate in such a ritual, she didn't force it. Now let me step back. Those are the stories. And I want to step back for a minute and share with you some of my analysis of these stories and what I think they reveal about healing practices. Are you okay?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to name, I'm going to name eight practices that I see in these stories. And I want you to know that I don't make grand claims for generalization because I've based this study on oral histories and biographies. Only five. And that's not enough. But sometimes deep reflection on life stories reveals things that are very important to know. And so I share these as a kind of teaser, inviting you then to join into this reflection. I'm going to name what I will call marks of healing practices, and so eight practices. Some I'll talk about more and some less. First is the practice of compassion and empathy, which is evident in all the stories. Compassion and empathy. In Gloria White Cameron, we see an ever-expanding circle of compassion. Her work as a pediatrician and pastor led her to see needs beyond her local world. And when she saw it, when she made her early journeys to Africa and engaged in work with people in Africa, she became aware of that her compassion was expanded to ever widening circles. She spent a lot of time in the Sudan, so her early work in the Sudan spread her compassion circles to Darfur. And she has done a lot of focused work in Darfur in recent years. So compassion that just keeps expanding out. We see compassion also in Mary Garrett Taft's experience of passing the house and hearing a child's cry. And I want to speculate a little bit on this compassion and suggest that not only was she hearing the cry, but as a nursing mother, her milk glands probably let themselves down, and she probably felt that cry in her body. So compassion is not just something from here to there. Compassion can be grounded in your entire body. Nampilo Mandondo, similarly, has a bodily compassion with women who had been sexually abused. And therefore, she wants to stay in touch with her own abuse experience. She's not stuck on it. You remember the quote, she moved on? She's not preoccupied or stuck on it in a narcissistic way. She wants to stay in touch so she can be in touch with the pain of other women who suffer sexual abuse. So this is compassion that we might call body-to-body compassion. Now, before leaving the mark of compassion, I want to make an observation about Dorothy Ripley, the one who had the dramatic religious experience and felt called to go to Africa. Her compassion was of a very different kind. It was more of a generalized compassion. It was a generalized compassion for a people who she knew to be oppressed. She knew that they were being violated, but she didn't know them. She only had this general sense when she began this journey. Later, she came to know a lot of people, and her compassion developed much more particularity. But I want you to know that in England, at the time that she had this vision, there was a kind of idealization of Native Americans and indigenous African people. And the idealization was often used as a way to protest slavery and to call for more humane relationship with the continent of Africa and with the native peoples of what's now the U.S. However, it was also a way of stereotyping, because the idealization was just a sort of flat portrait. It was so ideal that no human being could be like that. It was the ideal, quote unquote, native. And so we can even guess that Dorothy Ripley's compassion was not only generalized, it was probably pretty naive. And yet her compassion, however generalized or naive it was, led her to act. And her action led her into encounters that not only deepened her commitment, but it helped her understand real people better. And that deepened her commitment still more. A second mark of healing practices is the practice of opening to God, or opening to the holy. And here I'll just refer to two of the women, but the first one is Dorothy Ripley, who had that dramatic religious experience in her bedroom at the age of 20. That experience funded her ministry for decades thereafter, because it was kind of an anchor. She was to have many more religious experiences, but she kept going back to that as a kind of anchor to her calling, and a confirmation that even on this solitary journey, she knew God had called her. Similarly, Nampila Mganda kept returning to her closet mother. She could not go back, because there was something about this holy relationship and this holy calling that would not let her go. And her natural mother recognized it and helped her to go back. A third mark is the practice of holistic healing, which is tending to persons' bodies, tending to their relations with the holy, to their social relationships, and to their relationships with larger social structures. So you have people like Mary Taft who go pray individually with people, or get people to come to her kitchen and they pray with them there. But then you have people like Dorothy Ripley whose focus on larger social structures. This was long before people started talking about social analysis. But her very ability to have compassion that's generalized made it possible for her to look at social structures and work hard to change the social structures in this country. Anna Howard Shaw was motivated to not only pastor a church, but to heal people's bodies, and so she needed another medical degree in addition to her theology degree. Similarly, Gloria White Hammond also has a theology degree and a medical degree, and her work in Darfur includes at least these things: the practice of medicine, political negotiation, community building with the people, and joining with the people in building educational systems and other social infrastructures. That's holistic healing. Fourth, the practice of speaking, whether in storytelling, preaching, or engaging others in dialogue. Here we'll begin with Nampila Mganda. Nampila Mganda, whose own healing began with telling her story, and who has come now to see that inviting others to tell their story, inviting others to speak, to give voice to their experience, is essential to healing. She recognizes too that that's only the beginning, so that's not the only thing she does. All of the other women in this group of five are preachers. And most of them were also teachers. Most of them were also involved, and all of them were involved in active dialogue with other people. And so you have Dorothy Ripley going to this individual, whether it be Thomas Jefferson or a planner she happens to run into in the market, and just confronting them. But you have her speaking before Congress, and you have her speaking in larger settings. You have people teaching things in their homes, like Mary Taft. And in Gloria White Hammond's case, you have the Red Tent, for she's bringing Jewish and Christian women together to engage in dialogue. So speaking, whether preaching, storytelling, or dialogue, are critical practices of healing for these five women. Fifth is the practice of drawing upon one's own agonies, wisdom, and strength as a source of power in ministry, or as a source of healing. Drawing upon one's own agonies, wisdom, and strength in one's practice of healing. Anna Howard Shaw was rebuffed in her ministry and community leadership. And every time she was rebuffed, that strengthened her to struggle harder for something else. It was all of those experiences of being rebuffed that led her into the temperance movement and into the struggle for women's suffrage. Certainly, Mampilo Mandondo lived through agonies that most of us can't even imagine and don't really want to imagine. She has discovered that it's her very experience that is the strength of her ministry. It's her experience that draws people to her, and it's her experience that allows her to walk this journey with others and to have some wisdom about what kind of ministry might truly be healing for the women who come to her. Now, two more marks that I'm going to name very briefly have been implied already by the others, but I want to name them specifically. One is the practice of advocacy. If you like numbers, I'll call that number six. Dorothy Ripley, certainly. Anna Howard Shaw, certainly. But all of these women, in their diverse ways, were advocating. They were advocating within their communities, and they were advocating across communities. Political negotiation, I mentioned, in relationship to Gloria Whitehead. Now, in her case, she's advocating alongside others. She's not advocating for people to other people. She's joining with people who want to advocate for themselves and helping that happen. Finally, the last mark that I'll name, the second to last, this is number seven, is the practice of ritual. Some of the women here that I've named couldn't fit into those structures. You know, there are a lot of people today who can't remain practicing Jews or practicing Christians because they just can't live within the structures. Their calling is to leave the structures. And there are others who find it very painful to live within the structures but feel that their calling is to stay in the structures and work for change. And that's true of these women. The ones of these women who stayed within the structures, like Pampilo or Mary Taft, was practicing rituals that fit those structures. So they were more ritual-focused than some others like Dorothy Ripley, for example. But it's no accident that Gloria White Hammond is both a pastor and a pediatrician, both working in her local Boston community and in Darfur. Because all of this is a whole for her. These aren't different pieces of her. This is her whole. And finally, one last practice. The practice of discernment and courage. I already named the practice of opening to God or opening to the holy. But here I want to actively name the practice of discernment and link it with courage. Every one of these women spent massive amounts of time discerning. They all had some kind of experience of the holy. Some kind. But they all had to discern, not only at the beginning of these journeys, but repeatedly throughout the journeys. And their discernment continually led to places that required courage. So the practice of discernment leads one to act of courage, and the practice of courage encourages one to discern further. And so when we look at, I'm going to return to Dorothy Ripley's words here, the solitary path that I took. Who but a God of everlasting strength could have brought me safe? It's the discerning of God's lead that encouraged her to be bold. And so we're left with daunting challenges if we take these women's stories into ourselves and allow them to inform our paths.
I didn't make it. Oh, I left 10 minutes. 10 minutes.
So please, you don't have to comment or ask questions of me. I would really like to hear you build on this yourselves in whatever way you feel moved.
I was moved by your story of the woman hearing the cry of the baby and how I would be so hesitant to say it's none of my business what's going on in that house and maybe think about doing something and then saying, probably not. And yet how beautiful, what engaging beauty happened because of the risk.
And she later referred to that story as being a kind of launching, that's my language, being a kind of launching of her ministry. So those little steps that we might not even take because of what you just said can lead to bigger and more steps later. Yes.
I think we undervalue the power of ritual in healing. Mm-hmm. We sometimes depend a little bit too much on the structures that are around us rather than being creative as women. Mm-hmm. We know what we need, but feel we're not empowered to create rituals that we need to make bridges and healing places for our lives. Mm-hmm. And so we may fit into the church or on the edge of it or whatever, but we do not explore that possibility.
And if we go to anthropology and think about, draw from Victor Turner and think about liminal space, many of these women were ministering with people who were in liminal spaces, mm-hmm. on the margins of society or suffering from one kind of persecution or another and just are just not quite fitting in.
But they themselves have become liminal in order to be with those people and learn that.
That's wonderful. And ritual, if you stick with that, is what helps you live within or move beyond the liminal spaces. Well, that's brilliant, Amani Shiva. Others?
Just one thought. One refrain that I've heard is the willingness to breach social conventions of silence. Mm-hmm. And I mean more by that than just what my words might seem to imply, because I think all of us live within so many social conventions of silence. There are things we feel moved to say that we don't say. because somehow it's not appropriate, or it might get us into more of a conversation than we want to enter into, or because our words might be misinterpreted. There are just so many ways in which we are hemmed in by these conventions of silence. And I'm also struck by how risky it is to risk breaking. Mm-hmm. And how easily misinterpretation of motive and so on can result from that. But even in a group of women like this one, where in many ways I feel very free, I'm also struck by the many conventions that govern how we relate to each other. And I'm not sure I have a point to make. I just wanted to say that the stories you told and the women who displayed such courage, how many of them were daring to break those social conventions?
They were, and there's an interesting complexity in that. If I can look at Muganda, for example. most, she did not report the gang rape to the police, and most of the women who come to her have not reported, because that would be one of those risky breaking of silence,
that's right,
or risky ways of breaking silence. So there was a, so it's interesting that her ministry is one, or her religious practice is to speak and invite others to speak. But it's within certain kinds of contexts that are safer.
That's right.
I think Kathy underscored something that I was also thinking about, the conventions of silence and how we keep them. And I know for myself that I never wanted to talk about healing and healing rituals and the fact that I engaged in them. And then I noticed last year that my district superintendent, she wasn't at the time, but she mentioned that she's doing healing services, and I said, how wonderful. I didn't know that anybody talked about that kind of thing in these parts, and so that way I got to engage with her and become engaged in healing rituals, and in the very sacred, I mean, silence is, there is silence that is confining, and there is silence that is expansive. And we have to understand that very slim boundary, that line.
Yeah. Fascinating. Others? Sam.
Money that struck me was companioning. That implied in many places and sometimes explicitly that they had mentors or mentees and other sisters and sometimes brothers that were there for them. And in fact, connecting that to the story of Bishop Fisher's being at the doctor's when she was alone, and how sometimes even when we're alone, we need to bring our companions in with us, be able to have voice to break the social conventions of telling us to be silent.
Or again, referring to what she was talking about, you also emphasized the role that all of us have in reaching out to those who might be alone and not know how to reach out to us. And that's a part too. Yes.
Connecting with the silence that we keep, I would lift that up in conversation with the prayerful discernment that you've already mentioned. That a practice of prayerful discernment, not to prevent you from taking an action, but particularly when it's done with others, to give you the courage for action, informs when and how and with whom to break that silence. There is a phrase that I've used over my adult lifetime anyway, revelation not applied is revelation denied. So if God's self reveals something, perhaps through prayerful discernment, and you have that aha, it's undeniable moment, but it is not applied, you basically deny that it happened. And that's a self-imposed silence. I dare not live it. And so I would encourage that, put these in context, because I think that's true of all these practices. It's not one or the other. It's, they're so connected.
And the discernment is sometimes a discernment to be silent. Can I make just one other observation that connects this with Wendy's presentation earlier today? I'm also struck, as you were going through the history, how much we are connected to our legal system and the decisions of our Supreme Court, or the decision of other courts. And how much we're also conditioned by the professionalization of the medical community, which thwarts what Imani Sheehy was talking about in terms of, and what Laura was talking about too, in terms of ritual and other practices of healing. It's harder to be holistic in our healing practices when we live within some of the social constraints. Hate to leave with a name a problem. But thank you so much. Thank you. And thank you. This woman and Kathy Darr had planned this day, and they have done a fabulous job.
Today that you are not satisfied yet, so you have to come back after the dinner and fully satisfied 100% about our lecture and the discussions and also the your prayer and concerns about women and health, we hope. But you also, I know some of you are going to make the act on that, we pray. And so in order to do that, we have to nourish our body and our spirit. And the great dinner is ready in another building. So you are going to have some exercise for 3 minutes. And then I believe our the steps will let you know where you have to go. Basically, you just go out and take the... But it's, we are going upstairs, and then you have to go outside the building. And you will see the building the other side, 745 Commonwealth Avenue. And then we have to go downstairs in the basement of that building, and you will see the whole great dinner is ready for you. And while you have a dinner, you can have some the small group talks about our lecture. If there is any questions that you have, and then you just write it and give it to me. And so when we have a panel discussion tonight, the questions will be reviewed by our three guest speakers, and then maybe some answers will be provided.
If you forgot what you ordered for dinner on your folders, by underneath your name, you'll say dinner, and then an S or an R. S is for salmon, R is for ravioli. So when they ask you what you ordered for dinner, and if you want to have dinner and you do not, I order it yet, okay?
We will come back here at 6:30.
Yeah.
Yes, all right, let's see. anything else?